Thanks very much, Philip, and thanks to all of you for having me here at the at your foundation seminar. So as Philip said, I'll be talking to you today. I'll be telling you about some joint work that I did during my PhD with Roger Kolbeck, who is currently at the University of York. And I'm myself now at ETH Zurich doing my postdoc here. So this work is based on an archive preprint that I've added a link to here, which we've now submitted as a joint submission to PRL and PRA. So let's see how that goes. And this work, along with some extra stuff relating to this, which is not yet published, can be found in my PhD thesis, along with the poetic summary of this, if you're bored and interested in having a look at that, then you're most welcome. So I'll get started with an overview of the talk, of what's on the menu today. So I'll first give you an overall motivation for this project and tell you about this particular post-quantum scenario called jamming. And then after that, I will tell you about the framework that we develop for looking at causality, space-time, and how they fit together. After this, I will tell you about the seemingly provocative title, which is that you can have causal loops without superluminal signaling, at least mathematically or theoretically speaking. And I will tell you what that means. And then I'll also, if time permits, tell you how applying our framework to this post-quantum jamming scenario, we can actually show that it indeed leads to superluminal signaling, which is contrary to what has been claimed before in the literature. And then I will conclude with some conclusions and open questions in this direction. And if at any point you have any doubts, if something's unclear, please feel free to interrupt me and ask your question. And I'll be happy to answer. Okay. So needless to say to everyone in this audience, causality is a very fundamental concept to physics or just the very scientific method. Nevertheless, there's several different notions of causation, right? And very broadly speaking, there are two broad categories of notions of causality. On one hand, we have relativistic notions of causation, which are really tied to some concept of a space-time. There we say things like cause precedes effect, or you can't signal outside the future, or you can't signal back in time, and so on. And on the other hand, we have very operational information theoretic notions, which one can formulate in terms of, for instance, a framework for causal modeling, where you look at interventions on some systems and look at observed changes that these interventions produce and so on, as well as several other operational notions of causation in terms of the quantum circuits, in terms of probabilities, process matrix, and the list goes on. So this list here is by no means exhaustive on either side. And as I said, these relativistic notions of causation are closely tied to a space-time structure. And for instance, if we look at something like Minkowski space-time, we would often say that the causal structure of Minkowski space-time is acyclic, right? And you don't expect to see any closed time-like curves in such a space-time. You really associate these with more exotic solutions of GR, where the space-time itself is somehow cyclic, right? And on the other hand, on the information theoretic side, we can, in principle, formulate causation independently of a space-time structure. Like, what does it mean for, what are the events in your causal structure? What does it mean for one event in this causal structure to cause another, and so on, can be formulated operationally here. And most generally, on this information theoretic side, we can also consider situations where causation, you have cyclic causation. And this is not so weird as it is in the right side of the picture, right? For instance, you can have scenarios with feedback, and even the classical causal modeling literature, you often look at cyclic causal models to model situations with feedback. For instance, the demand may depend on the price, and the price may in turn depend on the demand, and it's convenient to look at this as a cyclic causal model. And more generally, you can also have this notion of causation without signaling, which you can really formulate operationally on this side. So we know that quantum theory challenges some of these notions of causation on this list. And one of them is these classical causal models, as Rob has shown in one of his really nice papers. back in 2015. And on the other hand, we also know that quantum theory is compatible with some of these other notions on this list, in particular things like no superluminal signaling. And right, so as I said, now quantum theory challenges some of our notions of causation. And in fact, this is because of Bell's theorem. And in response to Bell's theorem, there have been different approaches that have been proposed to for describing causality in quantum theory. And these are, this is like an overview of some of them, right? And on one hand, if you look at the Bell experiment, your causal structure is really what I've drawn here. So the black squiggly arrows, these black nodes denote somehow the causal structure of the experiment, and the blue lines you can think of as the light cones in Minkowski spacetime. So in this first case, you really are providing an explanation of the observed correlation. So basically, this is just a regular causal structure of a Bell scenario where you have Alice and Bob sharing some joint state and choosing the settings A and B and producing outcomes X and Y. And what Bell's theorem implies is that if we look at this causal structure here in part A, and we see that these correlations over A, X, B, and Y violate the Bell inequality, then we know necessarily that this lambda here cannot be a classical variable. So if we want our causal structure to be precisely this one, then we'll have to take to lambda being fundamentally something that's quantum, right? On the other hand, you could say that, well, I'm not happy with doing away with classical variables, but I'm happy with changing my causal structure a little bit. And then you could go to either B or C. In this case, you can continue to assume that your lambda is really some classical variable, and you modify your causal structure, for instance, now to allow A to have some causal influence on Y. So Alice's input has some causal influence on Bob's outcome, even though there's, in this space-time configuration, space-like separation between them, which would be, for instance, in Bohmian mechanics or any non-local hidden variable model. Or you can also have some situation where you allow the inputs of the parties to influence the lambda. So this would be retrocausality, for instance. And there are, of course, other options as well, right? And what you can see in these examples is that, for example, where you have red, additional red arrows, these are not necessarily staying within the light cone, right? Where the light cones are given in blue. So to consider all such possibilities, right? And also beyond the Bell scenario and in a more general causal structure, what we would need is a general framework that, first of all, disentangles causality from space-time. And another reason to do this is also that when I first talked about these relativistic notions before, when we say something like no superluminal signaling, this in a way mixes the space-time, an idea of space-time along with something that's operational. Like when we say signaling, this is a very operational thing. And when we say superluminal or outside the future, this is something related to the space-time. So some of these notions that I listed before are really mixing operational aspects as well as something we call space-time, which maybe is not so clear a priori what that means, right? So first step would be really to completely disentangle causality from space-time. And once we do this, as I said, there's no reason to assume that the causal structure is acyclic, because if we assume that it's acyclic, you're kind of singling out an arrow of time or some directionality in the causal model itself, even though you're modeling it operationally. So in the most general case, you can have cycles. And we also want to have situations where you have causation without signaling. So for instance, here, these red arrows, even though you have some causal influence going outside the light cone, we know that in the end, you're producing no signaling correlations. So these causal influences are not really leading to any signaling. Explicitly, you're forbidding that because you're trying to generate no signaling correlations, right? And furthermore, if we go beyond the Bell scenario, when we want to talk about signaling, correlations alone will not be enough to look at this. And the reason is that, for instance, in the Bell scenario, our inputs A and B don't have any prior causes. They're freely chosen. And in this case, if they're correlated with something else, so say the input of Alice is correlated with the output of Bob, we would say that there is signaling. because you know that one of the variables is freely chosen. But in general, if two variables are correlated, you can't say anything about is one a cause of the other, or so on. Right? And so one needs to also consider interventions. And I'll also explain what I mean by this. And finally, it's not enough to just separate causality from space-time. One needs to also know how to put them back together. Because on one hand, when you separate these two things, you could get a very general class of stuff, but you also know which among this general class of stuff is in principle physical under some conditions. So like if you put it back together with some acyclic notion of space-time and demand that this causal model does not signal outside the future in your space-time, then what are the constraints on this causal model and so on. So the framework also needs to be able to tell you this to some extent. And once you have such a framework, an interesting question to ask is that, is it possible to embed a cyclic causal structure, that is a cyclic causal model, in a space-time that's acyclic, like Minkowski space-time, without having superluminal signaling in the space-time, right? And so this question is also in a way interesting because, of course, when we look at standard special relativity and so on, we would think that if it's impossible to superluminally signal in any reference frame, like in any, then we would not be able to create a causal loop. Right? And this is what we tend to take for granted, at least when talking about, say, special relativity in Minkowski spacetime. But if you go to a more general framework where you don't assume this whole structure of the theory, but only have minimal assumptions and really try to characterize what like superluminal signaling means under these minimal assumptions, then it might not necessarily be the case that superluminal signaling rules out causal loops. And in fact, we will see that there is a way to have a causal loop in an acyclic space-time, which does not lead to superluminal signaling, but you can nevertheless, agents can verify the existence of this loop by doing appropriate interventions. So in a sense, this loop will be a bit different for example, from say the examples I've given here. So if we had something like example B, right? Like which, for instance, in Bohmian mechanics, there's really no way to verify that there is this causal influence just at an operational level, because you can really not distinguish between what is your underlying explanation, right? Like you also have this model A where there is no influence from one side to the other. But on the other hand, the causal loop that we propose here would really, you can, even though there is no superluminal signaling, there is a way to do appropriate interventions to verify that that really is a causal loop and there's causation backward in time. So the idea would be to now build up this framework so I can give you this example. I'm by no means claiming that it's physical, but it's more a mathematical possibility. Right. Okay, so apart from these foundational motivations, there's also some practical motivations for considering cyclic and fine-tuned causal models. And where by fine-tuning, I mean what I mentioned before, which is having causation without signaling or causation without correlation. So an example, a very simple example would be the cryptographic protocol of the one-time pad. And in fact, we require this property of fine-tuning in several cryptographic protocols because we want to hide some information from being accessible. So for instance, in the one-time pad, you have a message M and you have a key K. So let's say that both of them are classical bits. And suppose the key is uniformly distributed, right? So what we can do to encrypt this message is simply take the XOR of M and K and we produce an encrypted message ME. And now we know that we really generated ME using M and K. So really in a causal model, both M and K would be causes of this final encrypted message. But we also know that since the key is completely random, just looking at ME, we have absolutely no information about M, right? If we don't have access to K. So in this sense, M will be uncorrelated with ME. And you can also say that M does not signal to ME in this, like under interventions in this causal model. But nevertheless, we know that M is a cause of ME. And we also know that if you take M and K together, then we will be able to now signal to or will be correlated with ME again. So in general, you can have situations where a variable or a system is uncorrelated with another one, but it's nevertheless a cause of this other system. And you might be able to detect this by now, not just looking at these two systems, but also considering other systems together. Okay. And secondly, there's also this class of post-quantum theories that go beyond standard no signaling generalized probabilistic theories, which have been proposed, for instance, in these two papers. I've got the wrong references here, it should be 2 and 3. It's claimed that these slightly larger set of correlations than the standard no signaling correlations are still compatible with relativistic causality in the sense that they don't let you signal outside the light cone. And such a framework, as I described before, would allow us to also talk about these post-quantum theories and signaling and so on there. And another aspect would be to look at this causal discovery problem, because if you're considering both interventions as well as correlations, then you can, in principle, apply such a framework to a causal discovery problem, where the idea is to look at a bunch of observed data, which would be you can observe some correlations, and then you can go and perform some interventions, and then collect the observed correlations after that. And you want to use all this observed data to infer what the underlying causal structure or causal model is. And while doing so, often an assumption is made, which is that you don't have fine tuning. That is, you don't have this kind of causation without correlation. Because if you want to be able to say that if I see that two things are completely uncorrelated, I would want to believe that there's no causal influence or any causal connection between them. If you have fine tuning, then this assumption no longer holds. So by studying cyclic and fine tuned causal models, then they could have potential applications for causal discovery in these settings. And finally, it also allows us to look at cyclic quantum causal structures, because once we really separate causality from space-time, there's no way to distinguish a physical scenario with feedback from some exotic closed time-like loop. The math is the same. And the difference will come about depending on how you take this causal model and put it in a space-time. So for instance, if you have a cyclic causal model describing a situation where the demand depends on the price and the price depends on the demand, you know that physically this is not a weird closed time-like curve. What's happening is that the price at time one influences demand at a later time, t2, and then this influences the price at an even later time, t3, and so on. So you can really unravel it in time. In a sense, looking at cyclic causal models could kind of have this more practical application of modeling physical situations as well as more exotic situations, depending on how we connect it with space-time. That being said, let me review what this jamming scenario is that was proposed in basically these two papers I cited here. So the idea is that you have a tripartite Bell scenario. Let me just point out that the notation I'll be using is that these squiggly arrows here will denote causation in our framework. And you'll soon see why, because we would want to later categorize them into dashed and solid arrows and so on. So in general, I'll draw causal structures in black with squiggly arrows. And another thing would be I will try to put all concepts that are more related to the operational side or to causality side in blue, and things related to space-time more in this brownish or yellowish color. Then in this jamming scenario, what one considers is a typical tripartite Bell experiment. So you have Alice, Bob, and Charlie with the settings A, B, and C, and outcomes X, Y, and Z. And they share some common state, which we denote by lambda. And they're also in this space-time configuration I've shown here. So this is just a Minkowski space-time diagram. And these 45-degree lines are just light cones. And as you can see, the parties are basically pairwise space-like separated with the condition that you look at the joint future of Alice and Charlie, which is this brown region here. This is entirely contained in the future of Bob. Okay. And so in this situation, First of all, one can look at what the standard no signaling conditions are in this tripartite belt scenario. And these would simply tell you that the outcomes of any subset of parties cannot depend on the settings of the complementary set of parties. Right? And in particular, in the no signaling condition would tell us that the outcomes X and Z of Alice and Charlie cannot depend on the setting input, the input of Bob, neither jointly nor individually. Right? That's what these three conditions tell us. But what is argued in these two papers is that if we are guaranteed to have this space-time configuration shown here, then we actually don't need this first condition. It's because this first condition can only be verified when you bring X and Z together. You can only compute these correlations, joint correlations between X and Z, when you bring X and Z together, which you can only do in the joint future of X and Z, which we've arranged that this is fully contained in the future of B. So in these papers, they propose a slightly larger set of correlations, which is exactly the standard no signaling correlations minus this constraint. And this is what now I'll call the jamming correlations, or in the second paper, they call it the relativistic causal correlations, because they claim that this is now the most general set that is compatible with relativistic causality. But I will stick to jamming because we are later going to show that it can violate relativistic causality. So what we need to remember is that these jamming correlations, the defining conditions, I would say, are these three, right? So that in general, you need not have that X and Z. So in general, X and Z can be correlated with the input of Bob. But individually, X is independent of Bob and Charlie's settings, and Z, which is Charlie's outcome, is independent of Alice and Bob's settings. Okay.
And Vilasni? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Rob has a question.
Yes, don't. Rob, please go ahead.
Yeah. Sorry. If you could, I think this is the slide. I just wanted to understand whether the fact that Alice and Charlie can only get together and compare the results in the future light cone of Bob is an artifact of this particular geometry. So if I imagine Alice, Bob, and Charlie forming a triangle in two-dimensional space, mm-hmm. and is it conceivable that Alice and Charlie, and maybe Alice and Charlie, are closer together to one another than they are to Bob, then presumably they could get together and look mm-hmm. at their outcomes without being in the future light cone of Bob. Mm-hmm. So I guess I'm wondering whether the claim here is that there exist geometries wherein Alice and Charlie couldn't get their outcomes together without being in the future light cone of Bob, and we want to focus on those geometries. Is that like the motivation for dropping these conditions?
Yes, exactly. So it's really a condition that's tied to the space-time configuration. So in space-time configurations where Alice and Charlie can only get together in the future of Bob, then these are the set of correlations. But as soon as now, for instance, you can imagine them moving around, and as soon as they move around right. such that now they're no longer, their futures are no longer contained in Bob, then you're back to the standard no signaling condition.
Got it. Okay. And so in the same geometry, you would not want to, like Bob and Charlie could get their, look at correlations between their outcomes outside mm-hmm. the future light cone of Alice. So you wouldn't want to drop that corresponding condition.
Exactly. So you have all the conditions, and the only one you drop is this one, because in this particular geometry, Alice and Charlie can only get them together in the future in Bob.
Good. Yeah. And on your next slide, you were just dropping that one condition. Is that, did I have that right? The one, the yes. slide after this one.
So this is the previous one, and the only one I dropped is the first one, which is precisely corresponding to the condition. And okay, I didn't mention the other conditions, but they're all the same. So it's just that the outcome of any subset of parties can't depend on the settings of the others, except this one very specific condition. So that's the only one that's true. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Yes, so it's called jamming correlations because in some sense, Bob now, by choosing different settings, can somehow decide what correlations Alice and Charlie share. So for instance, it could be that when Bob is setting a zero, the distribution over Alice and Charlie maybe corresponds to that of a PR box. And when Bob is one, it corresponds to a different relabeling of the PR box. Or it could be correlations associated with one maximally entangled state when B is zero, and when B is one, it could be that of corresponding to a different null state. So now Bob can kind of influence jointly the correlations between Alice and Charlie, but he can't influence the particular outcome of Alice or particular outcome of Charlie. Okay. And one important thing to note here is that clearly there's some influence that Bob has on Alice and or Charlie, right? And in order to model the situation within a causal model, we need to allow for some additional causal arrows, which I've shown here in blue, connecting B with X and Z. Right? And we actually show that if you don't have this, then you can't describe these correlations in a reasonable causal model. You need to have this causal connection between B and X and Z in order to see some correlations in this causal model. So in general, you have to modify the causal structure of the tripartite Bell scenario by adding these blue arrows in order to accommodate these jamming correlations. Okay. So let's now get to the framework. Yes, I see a question. Please go ahead.
Can you go back one slide?
Mm-hmm.
So you said Bob can only influence the joint probability of X and Z, but it cannot influence individual one. So the joint probability lies in the future light cone in that greenish region. Mm-hmm. So it's can you say that there is some sort of retrocausal because the joint probability is in the future of the single X and Z, but it kind of will influence X and Z?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's a very good question. So indeed, like if you think of this causal model as being put on top of the space-time diagram I drew here, these blue arrows are going from B to X and Z, which are outside the light cone. So B and X are, for instance, space-like separated. So you could certainly find a frame in which X happens at an earlier time than B, and it looks like this retrocausality in that frame. So in this here, so you can already see that there is some flavor of retrocausality here, even though, like from this argument, it seems like there's no signaling outside the future because they can only verify these correlations in the joint future. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Right. So now I'll tell you about the framework. So for the causality part, we will follow the causal modeling approach, but try to use as minimal assumptions as possible. So let me give you an overview of how we model the cyclic causal structures. So a causal structure for us will just be a directed graph. And the nodes of this directed graph can either be observed or unobserved. And observed nodes correspond to classical random variables like your settings and outcomes, right? And unobserved systems can either be classical, they can be quantum, or they can be some post-quantum systems, right? And these squiggly arrow edges denote causation. So that's the causal structure. But now, in order to make any operational predictions about this causal structure, we need to assign some observed probability distribution with this causal structure, right? And as I said, the observed nodes, these are all classical random variables, so we can assign a joint distribution over them. For instance, in the standard Bell scenario, you have some shared state lambda between Alice and Bob, and their settings are A, B, outcomes are X, Y. The observed distribution is the joint distribution over A, B, X, and Y, right? And this is the causal structure of the Bell experiment. And in general, I will denote observed nodes with a circle around them, and unobserved nodes will not have a circle around. Right. And now we have the graph and we have the distribution, and we need some minimal condition to connect these two things. When is the distribution compatible with the causal structure? And for this, we use this so-called de-separation condition, which I will not necessarily define the whole thing here, but the idea is just that certain separation properties in the graph imply corresponding independences in the observed distribution. So for example, in our Bell causal structure, if you have this causal structure, you can see that now the setting of Alice, this is A, and the outcome of Bob Y are not really connected, right? And then due to this, the no signaling conditions really follow from the topology of this graph. So you can show that really X given AB will be X given A, and probability of Y given AB will be probability of Y given B. And this follows from the so-called these D separation properties in the graph. Okay. So we will simply define the compatibility of an observed distribution with a causal structure by demanding this D separation condition, which is simply saying that if there's some separation between certain nodes in the graph, then the corresponding distributions should exhibit the corresponding independences. So importantly, we don't require the converse, right? So what does the converse mean? The converse means that if I see some independence in my distribution, then I should also have disconnectedness in my graph. But this need not always be the case. So for instance, if we recall this example we had before with the one-time pad, there we had that a message M was a cause of this encrypted message E, but nevertheless, the distribution was such that these were completely uncorrelated, right? Unless we had the key. So in general, if this converse property also holds, we will call the causal model faithful. And if this doesn't hold, the causal model is called unfaithful or fine-tuned. And in fine-tuned causal models, as I said, you can have causation without correlation. So you will see that there's no correlation between certain variables. So there are independence relations in the observed distribution, but nevertheless, in the causal structure, there's some connection between them. So then you won't have the deseparation. Okay, so we only require one direction of this condition for compatibility of an observed distribution with a causal structure. Yeah. And we don't make any further assumptions about the unobserved nodes, so they could be anything. Yeah. Right. So far I've talked about correlations, right? And those are the minimal assumptions we make on the correlations in a causal structure. But as we know, correlation is not causation. We need something more. So the standard ubiquitous example is, suppose you find that smoking tendencies and the cancer detection in a population are correlated. Then this doesn't tell you anything about the underlying causal structure. It could either be that smoking causes cancer, or somehow being detected with cancer makes people take up smoking in some strange way, or that there is some unobserved and unknown common cause, some genetic factor that influences your chances of smoking and also your chances of getting cancer. And it could be any of these. And how do we distinguish between these, right? For this, we need interventions. So for example, suppose you had this scenario where smoking has some causal influence on cancer, but also there's some common cause. But you want to really figure out, is there a causal influence of smoking on cancer? Then what one could do is, in principle, you could force some people to quit smoking and see whether those people, their chances of developing cancer changes as compared to the original case where I didn't do anything, right? So you have two scenarios, one where you're only observing the correlations between these two variables, right? And you don't do anything, you're completely passive. And a second scenario where you go and make an intervention, and then you observe the distribution. So this first scenario is just the original causal structure G, and the second where you do an intervention on S will be G subscript do S, okay? And importantly, when we do the intervention, you're assuming that you freely choose what you're going to set S to be. You force some people to take up smoking, or you force some of them to quit smoking, and you do this independently of any prior causes. So your choice to force some people to stop smoking or take up smoking does not depend on whether or not they had this genetic condition, right? So in this ideal intervention, when you intervene on a node, you cut off all its parents in the causal structure and freely set it to be some value. And then you basically compare the distributions in these two models, the pre-intervention and the post-intervention model. So then we would say that in a causal structure where you have X and Y are some disjoint subsets of the observed nodes, that X affects Y if there exists an intervention on X that sets it to some particular value X, such that this condition holds. And what this condition is saying is essentially that, if we go back to this example, that there is a particular intervention I can do on S that is set it to force people to smoke or force people to not smoke, such that the probability of having cancer in this post-intervention model differs from the probability of having cancer in the pre-intervention model, right? And if this is the case, then you know that, okay, smoking is a cause of cancer. And in general, you can do interventions on multiple nodes in a causal structure all at once. Okay, so in general, you can have any causal structure and you can look at these kind of effects relations. And in a more operational sense, this captures the notion of signaling. So in the case that you're the node that you're intervening on, so say that S was already parentless, it didn't have any other parents to begin with, then clearly your pre and post intervention causal models are exactly the same. You're not cutting off any arrows coming in. And in that case, you know that if S is correlated with something, then it will imply that S really affects that thing. So that is a special case when the node you're intervening upon doesn't have any parents. But in the more general case, then one has to use this condition. And more importantly, this quantity on the left-hand side is not the same as the conditional distribution in the first original graph, because this is really a different causal model. Okay, right? So I won't go into the details here, but in the paper, we derive further rules for really relating the observed distribution in the post-intervention scenario and the observed distribution in the pre-intervention scenario in these general class of cyclic causal models under the only assumption that I had in the previous slide, which is this de-separation condition. So in particular, for those of you who are familiar with the causal modeling jargon, we derive these Pearl's rules of Du calculus from this assumption. But I won't go into the details of that there. Right. So now I've told you that in general, we have this causal model and we can do these interventions to verify, does X affect Y, right? And if X affects Y, this is an operational way to verify that X is a cause of Y, okay? But the converse is not true. So it could be that X is a cause of Y, but X doesn't affect Y. And this is like these fine-tuned scenarios, right? Like we saw in this jamming scenario that B is a cause of X or Z, but B doesn't really signal to either of them. So in terms of this effects relation, B will not affect X or B will not affect Z. So this motivates us to classify all our causal arrows. So remember that our causal arrows are these squiggly arrows. And we will say that if X, we have a causal arrow from X to Y, and we also can show that X affects Y, then this will be classified as a solid arrow. And if we have a causal arrow and we know that X does not affect Y, then we will classify this as a dashed arrow, right? And important rule, which I also mentioned before. So if it turns out that X is a parentless node and we see that X is correlated with Y, then this implies that X affects Y. So for instance, in the Bell scenario, the settings are free choices. For instance, the setting of Alice, A, if it's correlated with the outcome of Bob, Y, then we know that A affects Y because we also know that A is freely chosen. So this rule is a particular case that applies to Bell type scenarios where you have three variables. Okay. Right, so now let's look at an example. So suppose I have this causal model, I have X and Z, and Y is simply an XOR of X and Z. And let's say all of them are classical bits. Suppose that X is not uniformly distributed, but Z is uniformly distributed, okay? So now if you think about it, since X is not uniformly distributed, Y and Z differ by a variable that's not uniformly distributed, right? And this means they'll in general be correlated with each other. So for instance, if X is almost always or very close, has a high probability of being zero, then if Z is zero, I know that Y is also most likely to be zero, right? So Z and Y will be correlated and Z is parentless. So it means that Z affects Y. And this means that this arrow will be a solid arrow from Z to Y. On the other hand, if you look at X and Y, they differ by Z, but Z is uniformly distributed. So x and y are going to be completely uncorrelated with each other. And so this arrow becomes a dashed arrow, because then x does not affect y. Moving on. So just a quick recap of this part about causality before I move into the space-time part. So we try to model causation without referring to space-time structure and under relatively minimal assumptions. So we have a directed graph whose topology imposes some independence constraints on the observed correlations you can see in this graph. And since it's a directed graph, it can also have cycles in it. And going beyond correlations, we looked at interventions and these effects relationships. And we noticed that causation does not always imply signaling. So we classified our causal arrows based on which arrows lead to signaling and which don't. And I'm using signaling and sort of in the same sense as effects relations, because maybe signaling is a more familiar term. But so whenever I say that X signals to Y, then I formally mean that X affects Y in terms of what I defined before. And just for a comparison, in faithful causal models, there are a lot more relationships that make it much simpler to model. So for instance, causation and signaling are equivalent. And the only things that are not immediately implied is that correlation does not imply causation, which we all know. But in the fine-tuned case, you have things get a bit more complicated. As you can see, there are more things that don't imply each other. And so there are many concepts that become a bit distinct, which makes it also trickier to look at. And we have some more details of this in the paper. Yes. Now we move on to the space-time part. So again, we'll try to model space-time fairly minimally. And we model this simply as a partially ordered set. So for example, the partial order in the case of Minkowski space-time comes from the light cone structure, right? So if some space-time point is in the future of another, then it's later in the partial order. Right? And it's a partial order because there are no cycles. Okay. Right, and now to make any operational statements about this space-time, we have to put some physical systems onto it, because otherwise it doesn't have much meaning. And in our case, the physical systems that we can access are these observed variables of our causal structure, right? And these are random variables. So we'll only ever make statements about doing something with these observed variables, because those are the things you can take and you can access. Right. So the first concept we need is we take these observed variables, which are just random variables, and assign them a space-time location. So just a location in this partially ordered set. And we get an ordered random variable. So this is basically like what we call space-time random variables. It's just random variables with some space-time location, right? And the inclusive future of an ordered random variable is kind of defined in the obvious way. And since this variable is associated with a location in the space-time, the inclusive future just is the location of this variable along with all the locations in the space-time that are later in this partial order. Okay, so now we've seen that there are two types of order relations. One is this squiggly arrows of the causal structure, which will in general be a pre-order because you can have cycles. And then you have this partial order relation of the space-time. And then the question arises, how can this causal structure be compatibly embedded in the space-time? And in order to define this, one thing we have to define first is where can these ordered random variables be accessed in the space-time? Okay. Right. So for this, we define the concept of an accessible region of a random variable. Okay. And an accessible region of the random variable is just a subset of points in the space-time at which it's possible to have a copy of that random variable. Okay. So for instance, in Minkowski space-time, this is just the future light cone, right? But in general, we allow this to be any subset of the space-time, any set of points in the space-time. Okay. And from this, it follows that the accessible region of a set of random variables is just the intersection of the accessible regions of the individual ones. Because this is just, if I have X that has some set of locations where it's accessible and Y a set of locations where it is accessible, the place where I can access both X and Y is the intersection of these two regions. Yeah. Okay. So now an embedding in a spacetime is just you take a random variable, assign it the spacetime location, and assign it an accessible region. And this counts as an embedding. Of course, if we go back to our standard intuition about Minkowski spacetime, it might seem like it's a bit redundant to specify both, because once I tell you the location of the variable, then this also specifies where it's accessible, because we assume that it's accessible in its future, right? But here we really separate these two notions. So a priori, the location of the variable and where it's accessible are completely unrelated. Okay. So as an example, say this is again Minkowski spacetime, and these are the locations of x and y, and these primed versions are just some copies of these variables. So in general, the accessible region can be anything that's completely unrelated with the future of these guys. Okay. And this region here is the intersection of the accessible regions, is the accessible region of the set XY. Okay. So a priori, these concepts are completely unrelated. Right. And now we come to the notion of compatibility of this causal model with the spacetime, because at the moment we just have these two separate things and we put one on top of the other, but there's absolutely no relationship between the arrows of one and the order of the other. Yeah. So now we can ask, now we put the causal model on the spacetime, what ensures that this model doesn't signal outside the spacetime? So I don't want to be able to use the effects relations in this causal model to signal outside the future of the spacetime. So of course, one necessary condition is that if I have two variables, X and Y, such that X affects Y, then I should put Y in the future of X, right? This is a necessary condition. And if you think about it, if the model is faithful, then we know that signaling and causation are really equivalent concepts. So in that case, all the causal arrows will be solid arrows in our framework. So X affects Y would be equivalent to X is a cause of Y. And then ensuring that Y is in the future of X ensures that every causal influence goes within the light cone. Okay, so in faithful models, this simple condition is necessary and sufficient for ensuring that you don't have signaling outside the light cone, but not in fine-tuned models. Because as we've seen in here, you can have causal arrows that don't come with an effects relation, right? And the example was again this jamming scenario we saw before, where we had some causation going outside the light cone, but we nevertheless kind of argued that it might not lead to signaling, right? Yes, so the first example, as I said, was jamming. So there we had that B jointly affects X and Z, but B does not affect X and B does not affect Z, right? So the compatibility condition we propose in the paper is fairly involved. So I will try to explain it just with a couple of different examples. And I'm happy to then answer questions if you have some more questions about the details of it. So in the case of this jamming scenario, our compatibility condition would imply that you have to put the joint future of X and Z to be contained in the future of B, right? And this is what we saw, that the particular spacetime configuration in which you could allow B to jointly affect X and Z is one where X and Z can be jointly accessed only in the future of B, okay? And our compatibility condition in the special case of the scenario reduces to precisely that. A second example is this one-time pad kind of example, which is where you have X and Z, which are both causes of B, and you have that X and Z together affect B, but X does not affect B and Z does not affect B. So this is like, if you recall, the one-time pad where you had a message and a key, and you use that to generate an encrypted message. The encrypted message is independent of the original message or the original key, but the message and the key together will give you, will be correlated with the final encrypted message, right? And in this case, you would expect that B should be in the future of X and in the future of Z, which is indeed what our compatibility condition gives us, because we need both X and Z jointly to compute B. And then we want B to be in the joint future of X and Z in this case. Okay. Now we can have another example where we also have that X and Z affects B, but X affects B and Z does not affect B. Okay. So one is a solid arrow, one is a dashed arrow. And here as well, we would expect that B has to be in the joint future of X and Z. Okay. And so far it seems fairly intuitive what should happen. Now we can have another example, which if you see example 3 and 4 have exactly the same effects relations, that X and Z will affect B, X affects B, but Z does not affect B. But the underlying causal structure is different. Like in this case, Z is completely separated from B, like has nothing to do with B at all. So in example 4, it would be reasonable to expect that you want to put B only in the future of X, and you don't need to put it in the future of Z, right? Because Z could be anything, and there could be many things in the universe that are completely causally disconnected from the thing you care about, and you don't want to put this in the future of all those things, right? So in example 4, you want to put B only in the future of X, but not necessarily in the future of Z, yeah? And our compatibility condition will indeed give you this. So the way we distinguish between example 3 and 4, even though they have the same effects relations, is by a new concept we introduced called higher order effects relations, which allows us to distinguish precisely between these two scenarios. So if I don't give you the causal structure and if I just give you a set of effects relations, how do we know what are the conditions such that this set of effects relations is compatible with some embedding of these variables in space-time? So in the jamming scenario or in this collider example that I've given you, these are more obvious what it should be, but to distinguish between things like example 3 and 4, one needs to go beyond just these effects relations, because as you can see, you have the same effects relations, but we expect different compatibility conditions. So for this, we introduce this concept of higher order effects relations, which will be different between 3 and 4 and allow us to find out what would be the correct condition. And so I won't go into the details of these, but yes, but I'm happy to later take questions on that if there are any. Right. So are there any questions so far, or shall I move on to the, and also you should let me know how much time I've got.
You have like around 10 more minutes.
That's perfect. Yes.
Okay,
thanks. Okay. So now I'll move on to the part about these causal loops without superluminal signaling. Right, so a causal loop is just any directed cycle in our causal graph. And if you recall, we had to classify our causal arrows into solid or dashed arrows based on whether or not they're associated with this effects relation. So in a similar way, we now also have to, it makes sense to classify causal loops as being effects causal loops or hidden causal loops based on whether these loops are operationally detectable or are they operationally undetectable. Okay. So for example, what we call effects causal loops are basically causal loops such that if I'm given a set of effects relations, I can use these effects relations to conclude that any underlying causal model that could give rise to these effects relations must necessarily be cyclic, right? So, So for instance, if I have these effects relations here, that I have two variables, X and Y, I know that X affects Y and Y affects X, right? If you recall, whenever we have X affects Y, this means that X has to be a cause of Y in the model, right? And here Y affects X means that Y has to be a cause of X. So we kind of operationally detected that any model that can give you this effects relation has to have a causal arrow from X to Y and from Y to X, okay, right? And this is just one kind of effects causal loop. And more generally, you can have effects relations between sets of variables, and you can try to use that to certify that any model over these variables has to have a cycle. So for instance, I could have that X and Z together affect Y, and Y affects X and Z jointly, even though there's no pairwise effects relation. And this will also certify that any model over X, Y, and Z that gives you these effects relations has to be cyclic. because the first one tells you that there has to be some causal influence from X and Z to Y. And the second one will tell you that Y has some causal influence from to X or Z. And okay, we prove this sort of formally as well. And we can also have causal loops in some model, which could be in principle not detectable operationally, such that any effects relations that I get in that model could also be reproduced in an acyclic model. So this means that these loops are somehow hidden and you can't really detect them operationally. Okay? So effects loops are set of effects relations that certify that any underlying model that gives rise to them must be cyclic. And hidden loops are just really a specific model which has a loop, but gives rise to predictions that can also be reproduced in some acyclic model. Right. So let's look at examples. So this is an effects causal loop of type one, right? X affects Y and Y affects X. And in this case, if we think of putting X at a spacetime location and Y at a spacetime location, we would have to put Y in the future of X and X in the future of Y. And there's really no non-trivial way to do that, except put them at the same location, right? So there is no non-trivial and compatible space-time embedding for this kind of a model, okay? On the other hand, we can have this effects causal loop of type two, which is this one where Y jointly affects X and X and Z jointly affect Y, but there's no individual pairwise effects relation. And this is the one that actually has a non-trivial and compatible space-time embedding. So if you look at the first, or if you look at, for instance, this effects relation, X, Z affects Y, tells you that Y has to be in the joint future of X and Z. The first one tells you that Y affects X, Z, so the joint future of X, Z has to be in the future of Y. And for instance, this space-time embedding, where Y is really exactly at the earliest space-time location that's in the joint future of X and Z, fits the bill, right? Like you, if we have the situation, then you would not really be able to use these effects relations to signal outside your light cone, because the first one can only be verified when I bring X and Z together, which is in the gray region, which is now the future of Y. And the second one can also be verified in the same region, right? So you don't have superluminal signaling, but nevertheless, you can use these effects relations to verify that there is a cycle in the model. Right? And then the final example is of this hidden loop, where for instance, everything is a dashed arrow. So we have X and Z with dashed arrows between them and some unobserved lambda. And because these things are dashed arrows, X does not affect Y and Y does not affect X. And so if you only have access to X and Y, they seem completely uncorrelated and unrelated. But there's this underlying model that says that there's some causal loop between them. And I would prefer the explanation where X and Y are just completely uncorrelated with each other, rather than trying to add some hidden causal loops between them. So in that sense, the hidden causal loop is not really operational. Okay. So the main example was this one here, which is an effects causal loop, which means it's operationally detectable, but it would not lead to superluminal signaling in this particular space-time configuration. Yeah. And in a way, it's a particularly simple example since it's all classical variables and so on. In the paper, we look at further classes of these effects causal loops. And an open challenge that is still left is like a nice characterization of the set of all effects causal loops, which seems to be quite complicated. right. That maybe I very quickly tell you about this jamming and superluminal signaling without going into a lot of detail. So let me see. Yes, so if you recall, for the jamming scenario, we had this space-time configuration, and it was this tripartite Bell scenario. And the argument was that B jointly affects X and Z, but does not affect them individually. And so if we have this space-time configuration, we can only bring X and Z together in this joint future, which is in the future of B, and so we don't have signaling, right? But there's actually an implicit or a missing assumption in this statement, which is that we have to ensure that this lambda here is unobserved. So what we show is that if lambda is observed, right? So if these parties can actually access lambda, then they can use that to signal superluminally. And maybe I won't go into the proof, but the intuition is kind of similar to if you imagine something like Bohmian mechanics, where you have at an underlying level some causal influence going outside your light cone, but at an observed level there's no signaling. If we could actually go and access all the lambdas or the ontic states of the of Bohmian mechanics, then we would actually be able to signal as well. So in a sense, Bohmian mechanics also needs to have certain classical variables that are really inaccessible. And we show that even this jamming scenario would have to have these kind of variables. Even if they're classical, they have to be inaccessible even in principle, because if we could access them, then this causal influence between B to X or B to Z will actually turn into signaling if we can access the lambdas. So I would not then go into the proof of that. And there are a few other strange properties you can get with this jamming scenario, but I shall skip that as well and maybe quickly summarize. So what we had is a general framework for looking at causality and how it to separate causality and space-time and try to put them together under minimal assumptions. And so we looked at that in principle, you can have this kind of causal loops that don't lead to superluminal signaling, even in a Minkowski-like space-time. So this suggests in principle a general class of theories one could consider where you have some cyclic causal structure that nevertheless, when you put it in a space-time, doesn't lead to superluminal signaling. I don't know what kind of weird stuff one could do in such a theory, that's yet to be seen. And how to rule out these kind of causal loops, that's also something interesting to be seen. And then we saw that we can look at these post-quantum jamming type scenarios and also show that if you don't have additional assumptions about, you know, whether or not you can access the lambdas in this theory, then you can, in principle, signal superluminally in these scenarios, which is a bit contrary to what was previously claimed. And in principle, one could look for some applications to causal discovery, the causal discovery problem using these sort of higher order effects relations that we proposed. And that might be something interesting we would like to see eventually as well. And the take home message would be that I think, at least personally, I think it's important to separate causality from space-time, correlation from causation, and different notions of causation. There are several open questions, and maybe I already mentioned some of them, and some others that we're currently like looking at, which is some work in preparation with Renato, is to consider a more general class of space-time embedding. So for instance, in this framework that I showed you, we are really taking only classical variables and putting them at single space-time locations. More generally, you can think of trying to embed quantum systems in space-time, or you could try and embed it in a way that there's actually could be uncertainty in the space-time location of these systems, right? Rather than putting them in a single point, you could spread them out in a region, or try to look at situations where there's some superposition of trajectories of these systems in space-time and so on. So this is stuff we're now considering. Based on this kind of approach. And yes, thank you very much and look forward to any questions you might have.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I can take questions. Okay, otherwise I have questions about the causal loops.
Yes, so I go back to...
Like the simplest one where it's A causes B and B causes A.
This one?
Type one? I think X, yeah. I think I didn't understand like exactly in the formalism how it works, but do you have something like a grandfather paradox possible here, or does the formalism for interventions somehow prevent this?
Yes, so it prevents grandfather paradoxes, but not the other one, the information paradox, or it goes by several names, right? Unproved theorem paradox. So the grandfather paradox is avoided by demanding that there exists a valid probability, observed probability distribution over X and Y. So if you had a causal model, for instance, so a causal model over this graph would be one that gives you some function from X to Y and then another function for this arrow going from Y to X. And if you take one function to be an identity, another to be a bit flip, then you can show that it's not a valid causal model because the assumption that there is a valid distribution over X and Y would not work. But
I see.
Yes. But you can still have
this information antinomy. Yeah.
So you can have an identity in both directions. In this case, you can have many different distributions that are compatible with the graph, which is still fine in the framework. Yeah.
Okay. And just as a follow up, so you can you describe classical process matrices with this and causal inequalities?
Mm-hmm. So that's not something we do in this framework immediately, but this in preparation work I mentioned with Renato, so there we really, that would be the idea to try to do this kind of an approach for process matrices, and then look at what happens when you embed them in a space-time, what kind of process matrices are possible in an acyclic space-time, and it looks like you can rule out causal inequality violations with this compatibility type condition there.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, thanks.
But that's still in preparation, so I would want to make that claim very strongly until we check everything. Yes, Rob.
Yeah, Rob.
Yeah, thanks for the question.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for listening. My question is about way back when you first introduced jamming.
Yes.
What I was asking questions about previously.
Uh-huh.
Where X and Z. Yeah, I go all the way back to where X and Z are in the, here we go.
Yes.
So here's what I'm thinking, that let's take the version of X and Z, that are space-like separated in your diagram on the right.
Mm-hmm.
Things like, the parity of X and Z, mm-hmm. that's still a property, I'm thinking of X and Z as just, classical variables that are encoded in classical degrees of freedom sitting in those parts of space-time. And their parity is a property of that pair of bits. Mm-hmm. And so if somebody said to me, could B possibly influence the parity of X and Z? Mm-hmm. I would say, well, the only way that B could influence the parity of X and Z is if it affected X or Z, because the parity of X and Z is completely fixed by X and Z. Like you either have to toggle X or toggle Z to toggle their mm-hmm. parity. So I would have said that the condition on the far left at the bottom
mm-hmm.
Ought to be satisfied because the composite of X and Z it is just, supervening on the local properties of X and Z.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if on the other hand, you want to say, well, I'm not talking about the parity of X and Z at those points in space-time, as a property of the local X and the local Z, but sort of mm-hmm. the property of X and Z when they get together in the future,
mm-hmm.
then my objection would be, well, if I allow for, versions of X and Z to arise in the future, then not mm-hmm. only could B change the value of the parity of X and Z, it could change the value of X and the value of Z itself.
Yes.
Because there's versions of them that live in that causal future. So mm-hmm. I kind of don't see a natural story about how B could ever change something like the parity of X and Z
mm-hmm.
without, being able to change X and Z themselves.
Mm-hmm. So I completely agree with that intuition. So indeed, this jamming scenario is something that's weird, and I would not say it's physical in this sense at all. So in a way, it's what they claim is really that this is, they're looking at what are the necessary and sufficient conditions on correlations in the scenario that rule out superluminal signaling. And in the bipartite Bell scenario, they argue that it's the standard no signaling condition. But in this more general scenario, in the tripartite scenario, the standard no signaling conditions are not really necessary, in a mathematical sense, if you have this configuration. But of course, in a physical sense, I completely agree with your argument that it doesn't make sense to say that the parity of X and Z is something that's created in the future. It's something that's associated with X and Z itself. And I guess in a way one can see this in our model is that you can't describe it within the same causal structure. If you really look at the causal structure, it would, the causal model, it would really have influences from B to X and B to Z. And then you can construct a model where X is really a function of A and D, Z is a function of B and C, and so on, to describe these correlations. But it's just that once you put this model in this particular space-time configuration, it's weird because you have the space-like separation and so on. But on the other hand, if you actually put X and Z in the future of B, then you know that what I could really do is take B. So for instance, say that's X and Z, right? Like, so let's say there's lambda. We can set Z is equal to lambda. And we could say that X is just the XOR of B and lambda, right? Mm-hmm. So sure. Both could be lambda. And then now B comes along and says that, oh, I flip X or I don't flip X. And then the final correlations are still that, for instance, B is the parity of X and Z. But in the model, you actually use B to generate X, right? So once you put it in the space-time configuration, you could it would be probably, in that sense, it's analogous to, say, Bohmian mechanics, right? Where you have something that's going from B to X and telling X what to do, but it's kind of doing it at the underlying level. And if you can't see lambda, then you will never be able to use it as a signal. And this is precisely why once you have access to lambda, B and lambda together will signal to X. So in this space-time configuration, you can see that you can already bring B and lambda together at this location, and then you would signal outside the light cone to X. So it's really all relies on this lambda not being accessible. So in that sense, it's completely not physical for the same reason that you mentioned, but it's mathematically, I guess you could claim that it doesn't lead to signaling. And so in that sense, our loop would also not be physical okay. And for the same reason. But again, mathematically, it's possible. Yeah.
Great, thanks. I have a second question, but I'll leave it thanks till later and let some other people ask. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Matthew?
Yeah, I missed the beginning of your talk, so you may have already mentioned this. But I played around with Deutsch's model of closed time light curves in quantum mechanics in my undergrad a bit. And I was just wondering if there are any connections between what you're talking about here and his particular model.
Mm-hmm. So thanks for the question. So I haven't thought about the connection with Deutsch's model, but have thought about it more with this post-selected closed time light curve model. And it seems like one can really derive these kind of causal models that we have in terms of these post-selective CTCs. But I think there are these works that show that they're really not equivalent to Deutsch's CTCs, right? So in that sense, I'm not really sure. Because like in this Deutsch model, I suppose you can have some circuit that looks like a grandfather paradox, right? And still describe like its fixed point as being some mixed state that's going around.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Which you can't do in this post-selected CTC model. And one can also not do that in ours, because if you have this grandfather paradox kind of scenario, you will never get a valid distribution to be defined. So I would say that it's okay. More analogous to the post-selected CTC. Yes.
Okay, yeah, I was trying to draw the connection between his kinematical consistency condition, but mm-hmm. You're saying that this is totally different, that you don't have this. Mm-hmm. Fixed point operation, like you're not defining it through the fixed points of your super operators or something.
Yes and indeed it's not in terms of the fixed points. It would be just that you get like we define it under very minimal conditions that you get a valid probability distribution over all the observed nodes, and if one really goes into the causal model and looks at when this can happen, then you really you're kind of post-selecting on some things being the same. So whenever you have a loop, your fixed points are not distributions, but they're somehow values. Like if you look at the fully classical case, then somehow you want there to be actually a value that's a fixed point. Like you can talk about unique solvability of the model and so on. But in the Deutsch's case, it's more like you're allowing for fixed points that are distributions. And once you look at it in this causal model picture, it would be amounting to saying that since any sort of stochastic map or CPTP map has a fixed point, always has a fixed point, then in principle, you could have any model even with contradictory stuff. And that is not like allowed in this framework. So in that sense, it's different from the Deutsch's version.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Lee. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thanks. This is very interesting. There's a lot to unpack. In terms of a physical principle, if somebody were to sort of endorse special relativity as telling us that there is no signaling outside the future. But other than that, it's a free-for-all. So this person would have no problem saying we can have causation outside the future. Just the only thing that special relativity teaches is no signaling in the future. The example that you have here of a causal loop, which is not signaling into the future, but which is detectable as a causal loop via intervention. Would this be something that would be considered physically plausible? Because it seems to me like if we're talking about classical variables, then we assume that whatever nature allows us to do, it shouldn't prohibit interventions on classical variables.
Yes.
So we might have like hidden variables that are genuinely hidden. We can never access them, which would make the jamming correlations therefore sort of okay. Because if we trust that the hidden variable is really hidden, then there's no signaling. But the other example where you have like A and B affect C or vice versa, it seems that if one of the parties in that scenario decided to break the loop by taking whatever their outcome was and then passing forward a different value, independent of what they sort of saw, then the signaling would be detected. So would there be sort of like a principle that you would advocate for that the kind of causal structures that nature allows are only those which prohibit the possibility of signaling to the future, and not only those that give rise to correlations that are not necessarily exhibiting signaling to the future?
Thanks for the question. So let me try to see if I understood your question properly. Are you asking like maybe whether can one actually use our loop and kind of post-process something to actually signal, even though the loop itself doesn't signal? Or
Right.
Was that one of the questions, or in some sense?
I think well, I was assuming that. So is that the case?
That would not be the case, because like once, so indeed, like since you also mentioned the jamming scenario, it what is the case is that you also need a hidden lambda for our loop, right? So you do need to assume that there is some hidden common cause that's really hidden for this loop to work, and once the lambda is accessible, then our loop will also lead to signaling, just like jamming. So one could say that that's already somehow a physical principle, right? Like, and as Rob argued, and I think intuitively I would also agree with that, that one way is to say that, if you don't have signaling at the observed level, you should also not have it at the underlying level, or you should not have some classical variables that are fundamentally inaccessible no matter what you do, right? Like, and if one has that, then one also cannot have these kind of loops. But if you assume that the lambda really is hidden, then no amount of post-processing on those variables will allow you to signal. Maybe I go back to the example. So now if Y does any sort of post-processing on this loop, now this would be some Y prime, which Y is a cause of Y prime, and Y prime itself is not now a cause of X or Z. So in that model, then this anything post-processing you do is going to only signal to the future and not outside. But like the kind of experiment you would do to detect this loop, if you are somehow given a bunch of boxes that are really implementing this causal loop, would be that you go and do interventions on X and Z that are in the past over here, right? And then you wait until you get to this point. That's also the assumption is that when you do an intervention, you have really freely chosen this intervention, right? So in the experiment where I do an intervention on X and Z, it's really an experiment where now X and Z are freely chosen, decided what we want them to be. And I come in the future and see that this is actually correlated with Y, and I'll conclude that, okay, X and Z really are a cause of Y. And now I can do a second experiment to detect Y affects X and Z. And this is the weirder one, where someone here at Y comes and does an intervention on Y, right? And you really believe that you freely intervened upon Y. And then you wait until these two guys who have X and Z come along and tell you that, hey, look, actually your Y is correlated with something we produced in the far past. And like in principle, X and Z could be pushed as far to the past as you want along this light cone, and this would still work, which is really weird, right? Like, I mean, of course it goes with the belief that I really freely intervened upon Y, right? And if I believe that, then I would have to believe that I really had some causation going backward in time if I see that Y, it's free choice of intervention on Y is correlated with X and Z, even jointly. But no amount of post-processing on these things will allow you to signal up to the light cone, but you still have to have this lambda to be unobserved. Yeah, so I think you also asked what might be a physical principle to rule out these kind of loops. It's somehow maybe a no fine-tuning kind of principle, but maybe not no fine-tuning at the level of the causal model. But in a sense, if you look at the space-time embedding, the embedding is itself fine-tuned, right? So if Y really has to be at this exact point, which is the earliest point in the joint future of X and Z. And so the space-time embedding is kind of fine-tuned. You can't move like Y a little bit to the future, then you will no longer admit this causal model. So in that sense, somehow, yeah, it would be a no fine-tuning principle on the space-time embedding or something like this. But maybe one other thing I should point out is that this kind of fine-tuning in the model is a bit different from, say, like in Bohmian mechanics, right? Because there also you have some causal influence outside the light cone without signaling, but you also have a faithful model, which is just standard operational quantum theory that explains everything. And so you don't really need the fine-tuning. You can say that, okay, I prefer the faithful explanation. But here, like any model that gives you these kind of effects relations has to be fine-tuned.
That would be different. I'm not sure. Great answer. Yeah, that was more than I was expecting. Thank you. The other thing I just wanted to do was clarify the definition of when you say a set affects another set. Like what does it mean for Y affecting XZ and XZ affecting Y? Because you in a previous slide to this one, you had an example of a collider, but where there was actually nothing going on. There was no causal arrow. So it seems to me that, and tell me if I'm getting this right, that when we say that like set one affects set two, that tells me that everything in set one is a causal descendant of something in set one. So everything in set two is a causal descendant of something in set two. And moreover, that there is an observable correlation that like the conditional probability of S2 given S1 is not just the marginal over S2. Is that the read?
Yes. So indeed, like with respect to this sort of post-intervention causal model. So like once you intervene on, so set one affects set two means that, maybe I also go back to the definition of where I defined effects. So here X and Y are some sets of observed nodes. So we would say that X affects Y. If you now look at the post-intervention graph and look at the distribution of Y given some intervention, some particular choice of intervention on X, and this is different from the original distribution over Y in the original graph. And indeed it means that if X is a set, there's at least some element of X that is a cause of some element of Y. So it doesn't mean that everything in X is a cause of Y, but means at least one has to be. And then it's this higher order of X relations that we define that allow us to distinguish, okay, which element really is the cause and which is not. So then you're looking at things like, okay, does X affect Y given that some intervention on Z or given conditioning on some knowledge about intervention on other variables? And so that I didn't define here, but then this is something that you do in the paper.
Thanks.
Okay, thanks for the question.
Maybe I can ask another.
Yeah.
So this is maybe a more big picture question. Mm-hmm. One of the assumptions you're making, it seems to me, in the framework that you're using is that, you know, we talk about spatial temporal relations and we also talk about causal relations. Mm-hmm. And you're sort of examining sort of the interplay between those two types of relations.
Mm-hmm.
But you could take a different approach, which would be to say that the fundamental things are the causal relations, and the spatial temporal relations all are defined in terms of the causal relations, that they're sort of just emergent from the specification of all the causal relations. So yeah, I guess my question to some extent is, have you, you know, contemplated that instead, where so, like, you know, one difference would be, you know, maybe assuming retrocausation in a case where you're assuming space-time structure would be, okay, that's an arrow from some point later in time to some point earlier in time. Whereas if you thought that spatial temporal structure emerged out of causal relations, you might say, I could not embed this causal structure into a Euclidean space-time if I had cycles, for example. So I guess my question is, are you wedded to the idea that space-time is kind of fundamental and parallel to the notion of causation, or are you sympathetic to the idea that it might emerge from a deeper causal order?
Thanks, that's actually a really great question. And yes, I'm actually, even though here we're kind of, looks like we're taking this first approach where, okay, there is some background space-time over which you can embed this causal structure and so on. But I completely sympathize with the idea that, you know, the space-time structure is something that should emerge from this causal structure, right? And if you really look at this causal model, it doesn't look weird at all in some sense. Even as you said, if you have retrocausality, like in the model, there really is a causal arrow. And if you interpret the causal structure of the causal model as the space-time, as somehow defining the space-time structure itself, then this is not weird because things are going forward by definition. And in a way, so this ongoing work that I mentioned at the end that now I have with Renato, where we're looking at these more general kind of space-time embeddings, one could then interpret that in this, like, even though it sounds like, okay, you have space-time and you have causal structure and you're embedding it there, another way to see that would be that, okay, I have some operational predictions and I have some belief about what my space-time is like. Say it's Minkowski space-time. I believe that my world is, or at least what I can now test is, you know, can be described by Minkowski space-time. And so by embedding this model in the space-time, then you're checking whether does my operational predictions fit with this belief. So maybe that's another way to look at it rather than thinking of, okay, this is some space-time that's given to me, but it's this compatibility condition is checking whether the operational predictions of this model can in principle be reproduced in the space-time. And then you could have different compatibility conditions. For instance, here we only require this no signaling outside the future, right? So, which in principle allows your arrows to not really align with this space-time structure that one has picked. Another compatibility condition would be that, well, whenever a set X affects a set Y, I have to put it in a space-time such that at least one of the locations that I assigned to the set X is in the past of at least one of the locations I assigned to the set Y. That's a stronger condition than what we have. And that, for instance, would rule out these causal loops because it kind of ensures that you always have things going, like causal arrows are also going inside the light cone. So for instance, for this jamming scenario where you have B affects X and Z, it will tell you that B has to now be in the past of at least one of X or Z, and then you don't have this embedding. So, and that in a sense might be more natural, right? Like if you look at the causal structure, like in terms of D separation and so on, if we have X affects Y, then it really tells you that in this operational causal structure, at least one node in X is before one node in Y, which is, I think, maybe related to what Ellie asked before as well. And in that sense, it seems completely natural. Like if you could ask, if you have these set of operational predictions, does it fit with the causal structure? And this causal structure could be the operational causal structure of the network or of some notion of space-time I come along with and so on. So I would, to answer your question, I think I would personally also allude more to the, I think the second option you proposed, that the causal relations are more fundamental and then you can try to infer what kind of space-time its predictions maybe fit with or something like this, yeah.
Okay, yeah. One comment on that, which is perhaps you shouldn't restrict your attention to the question of embeddability within Minkowski space-time.
Yes.
So for example, if you have a causal loop, and you say, can I embed it in some kind of space-time? Then maybe an exotic space-time that has wormholes that yes. sort of allow you to explain mm-hmm. causal loops. But you know, the conclusion would not be impossibility of embedding in space-time, but you need an exotic space-time to accommodate this exotic causal structure.
Yes, indeed. So in this case, when I say Minkowski space-time, we're actually not really thinking of flat space-time or something, because the space-time is just a partial order. But mm-hmm. in principle, it could be any curved space-time, but it's just that it's not a space-time with a loop. So in principle, one could then just say that the space-time is a pre-order relation and not a partial order. And then you kind of can talk about embeddability in the cyclic space-times. But then this compatibility condition, like at least at this very broad level that we do, is not so interesting there, because then you can embed any model in a suitable cyclic space-time. But then if one is looking further into what kind of correlations you can get and other stuff, then it would be interesting to show, for instance, that certain kind of correlations, you really need like cycles, and you have to kind of go into these kind of cyclic spacetimes, right? And maybe like, yeah, that would be quite interesting as well. But yeah, so we don't really look at the full structure of the spacetime and assume it to be Minkowski, but really just at the level of saying it's a partial order. Yeah. So one could generalize it.
Thanks for that. Let me make one other observation, mm-hmm. which is on a different topic. Yes. So I found it useful to kind of introduce a distinction that it's about how to use the term fine tuning. Mm-hmm. So take the example of the Vernum cipher. Mm-hmm. There's kind of fine tunings which are, you know, evidence of an experimentalist or a cryptographer's, you know, capabilities. So when a cryptographer designs a Vernum cipher, well, they'd better make sure that the key is generated at random. That's just being a good cryptographer. Whereas if we're looking for explanations of phenomena we see in nature and we posit theories, and our theories require nature to have, you know, stipulated a very specific distribution among all possible distributions, mm-hmm. well, you know, nature choosing a particular distribution is very different from some cryptographer who's trying to, you know, design a crypto system choosing a specific distribution. And so, like in a Bell test, for example, to my mind, if I'm violating Bell inequalities, and I want to ask, is it plausible that there could be some local realistic explanation that nature is kind of contriving mm-hmm. to fool me? Well, you know, if I give a very implausible local realistic model, like there's nothing to recommend it. It's implausible that nature is doing that. But if an adversary is trying to fool me into thinking I've violated Bell inequalities, even though I haven't, well, you know, that makes it much more plausible that okay. kind of thing is like that fine tuned distribution is being mm-hmm. engineered by my adversary rather than by nature. So anyway, so for that reason, I like to use the word fine tuning sort of as a statement about what would nature have to mm-hmm. be like.
Yes.
But yeah, like in the case of the Vernum cipher, I would say that kind of causal, like the no signaling but causal presence mm-hmm. is something that one can easily see below, because, you know, we have access to the key, we could generate the key in a different distribution, we can mm-hmm. see that causal structure. The things that are unnatural are like Bohmian mechanics, wherein people yes. posit that there are distributions mm-hmm. that you cannot get around. Mm-hmm. You have yes. no possibility to access them. And so the causal relations are always there and you can never use them. Those feel mm-hmm. to me like very different hypotheses, the Vernum mm-hmm. cipher versus Bohmian mechanics.
Yes.
So my comment, I guess, is just, it feels to me like we should treat those mm-hmm. as different types of fine tuning.
Yes. I think, yeah, that's quite an important observation as well. And I agree. So the fine tuning, the way we use it, is really at the technical level of what a fine tuned causal model is. So, and in a way, maybe this relates to one of your previous questions as well. If you only look at the causal model, be the Bohmian case here, ours or so on, all these notions of fine tuning are the same, because you're not talking about the space-time structure in which it's put, right? Like even the Bohmian causal model, where you have LSS inputs that's affecting the outcome of Bob, it's just a different protocol in which, not the Bell experiment, but where Alice sends out something to Bob, and Bob could very much be in the future of Alice and do something, right? Like in terms of the causal model, everything is very well set out protocol. And at that level, there's one definition of fine tuning. But indeed, once we put it in a space-time and really interpret it as, okay, you know, this is really now this a causal structure that could be described by Bohmian mechanics, then I agree with you, then this distinction becomes very important. that, like in the Bell scenario, clearly we know that we have a better operational description without the fine tuning, where you know, nature does not conspire against you. And I would also personally go for the quantum causal model rather than the Bohmian one. Yeah. But at the level of just the causal model itself, while without looking at these spacer embeddings and so on, it's in a way just one technical definition of fine tuning, which really tells you, okay, what is the protocol you have to do to generate these correlations? So in that case, you really would take Alice's input and do something to generate like Bob's out. Yeah, but yes, I think maybe it's good to also have, like even in our community, like a different terminology for these two kinds of fine tuning. Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, I just had a very short question on the slide. So based on the definition that you have here for effects, it seems to me that if I have, let's say, A as a parent of B, which is then a parent of C, I would say, well, yeah, A could affect B, right? If I see that it makes a difference in the intervention. But then I would also maybe say that A and C affect B. Because if I intervene, and so is that like intentional? You want to say that like if something affects it, then supersets also automatically affect it, and if I can affect a set, then I can affect supersets. It's built in.
Yes, but actually, like so that is in general possible. But we also have some counter examples where you actually could have a causal model of this form, where you have some A is a cause of B, and then maybe C or like B is a cause of C, and like something else, and such that A affects B, but A and C together don't affect B. So this is also possible. So you could actually have a situation where a set affects something else, but a superset does not affect it. But you also can have the other way around where a set, actually you can have both cases, so in some sense.
Really?
Yeah.
Is this an artifact of the fact that like, I'm curious, you're only allowing like point interventions, and so it's sort of like if you marginalize out C, then you can see the effect of A. But if you were to set C to any single point value, then X's effect is lost.
Yes. So this is also an artifact of fine tuning. You would not expect this in any faithful causal model. It would, in general, be the case that if A affects B, then any superset containing A will also affect B. But this property fails in fine tuned models, which was also surprising to us at first. Because when you have fine tuning, what you can do is that, say, you have A affects B, but you have some other C, which is kind of a bunch of causal influences that are really canceling out. And it looks like C is doing nothing. It's just something that's sitting around. But as soon as you do an intervention, you kind of activate it. And then it behaves somehow differently. And so you can have a couple of counterintuitive things happening when you have a fine-tuned model. And so in that case, you actually can have. And for instance, even the effects relation need not be transitive. So you could have A affects B, B affects C, but A does not affect C.
Really? Are there examples of this in the paper?
Yeah.
No, take a look. Thanks.
If there's not more questions, I think we should thank Vilasini again. It's very interesting.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Thank you for all the very interesting questions as well.